Welcome to a special This Is Money podcast. The reason it's special is because we are actually recording this earlier in the week, because COVID willing, I should be out of the country sunning myself on a beach watching cricket. Why? Not because I think I've worked really hard and I deserve it. I think I have worked hard and I deserve it, but because I will be 40. Yep, it's true. So it got Simon and I thinking, not a huge amount because the brain fog gets in the way of that, of doing a 40 special. So we will be heading back to the 80s, talking about what's changed in the last four decades. Hopefully Simon will be helping me to feel a bit better about turning 40, as well as looking at some key personal finance milestones, such as how much should you have saved by 40, your pension pot, and what you can do if you're falling short, plus the life admin that we all put off, but really should get round to doing now we're 40. This is going to be possibly the most painful 35 to 40 minutes of my life. So far. Anyway, don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, Simon, when we first started this pod, I was a fresher-faced 32-year-old. I was listening to the podcast you did the other day with Stephen Bartlett, and you said, oh, it's been a few years. Oh, how time flies when you're having fun. It's a lot longer than a few years we've been doing this podcast for. Now, I am going to be 40. Simon, as the older, wiser among us, what's it like being 40? Any tips?
I'd just like to say that I haven't been 40 for the whole time we've been doing this podcast, only for some of it. I am 43. Mm-hmm. And the noticeable difference in my 40s has been minimal, I must admit.
Okay. You're not more sensible, not more mature?
No, not really. I think you probably, you're either going to get there by 40 or you're not going to get there.
Okay.
I think I'm probably never going to get there. So, yes, I must admit, the day after I was 40, I did manage to put my neck out whilst drying myself with a towel. And I was, I told someone who was one of my friends who was already 40 about this. He said, yeah, similar thing happened to me actually the day after I turned 40. He said, it's just downhill from there.
Marvellous.
But no, I'm not, in all honesty, I've not noticed any major differences. I should caveat that with the fact that a large chunk of my existence since turning 40 has been marred somewhat by coronavirus and lockdowns, therefore limiting the amount of stuff you can do. The one thing that I did notice in the year that I turned 40, and I've got a lot of friends who I went to school with, both me and my wife have, we've got a lot of friends who are turned 40 the same year or very close. And I've got a sister who's 2 years younger than me, wife's got a sister who's 2 years younger than them. I think the 40 year is a year where people suddenly start trying to do, they noticeably try to do stuff in the year running up to it. And then they seem to take a breath afterwards and maybe let some of that stuff slide. But I think it is a good time to, it's something that focuses the mind, I'm going to do something. Maybe it's even just doing a bit more exercise, trying to get a bit fitter, being a bit more proactive, all that kind of stuff.
You can tell from my face. So the year running up to it, I was supposed to be like giving it gusto. I really haven't, Simon. I'll be honest with you. I haven't really thought about it too much. I had a conversation with my dad who said, yeah, do you know what? I've never really been bothered about getting older, except turning 40. It was a worse year. Oh, okay, thanks, Dad. Thanks for that.
You have discounted what I just said about the pandemic stuff. It does severely limit you in a lot of the stuff that you can do. And actually, I think turning 40 is not that bad. It's more the 41, 42, 43 thing, because then it's a slippery slope downhill. It's the stuff after it, yeah.
Yes, I am going to blame COVID pandemic for not giving myself a full fitness regime and all that sort of thing. Anyway, let's head back, shall we, to 1982. 1982 was an eventful year. The Falklands War was taking place. Ozzy Osbourne at a bat live on stage, and a significant birth took place. Yes, the future King of Britain was born, but somewhere in one of the coldest winters on record, a young woman slipped on some ice in Norway, and I popped out a month early, stopped only by my mum's hand from being born down the toilet. I thought I'd share that with you. It's an inauspicious start in life, but here I am flying on this podcast with you, Simon. So in terms of finance, the state of the economy, if we back to Britain in 1982. It's a bit of a history lesson, this is. Looking forward to this one, Simon. As you were alive at the time, don't know if you remember that much about it.
No, I don't remember a huge amount about it, if I'm going to be entirely honest. I could probably pick out a few of those early memories that you're never quite sure whether they're your early memories or stories that you've been told. But objectively speaking, the good news is that we are living, materially speaking as well, in a much better place now. Were you to wander around 40 years ago, were you to jump in the time machine and wander around 40 years ago, or perhaps actually if you were to jump in the time machine and come forwards 40 years from 1982, you would find that we live in much better houses. Mm-hmm. We have much better access to things that we want and that make our lives easier. I mean, just to give the example of technology, is quite clear. It's always difficult to compare years when you didn't have a certain kind of technology to you do have a certain kind of technology. And certainly, you know, the internet may have corrosive elements and stuff like that, but it does make our lives quite a lot easier. Objectively speaking, our cars are better, our streets are better, our cities are better. If you want to go out for dinner, you're going to get a better meal. If you want to go down the pub, you're probably going to find the pub to be a nicer and more welcoming place to be. If you would like to go on holiday, you're going to find that that probably takes up a lesser chunk of your disposable income. And pandemic aside, you can go to more far-flung places and stay in better places. I think the only way to objectively say that 1982 would be better than it is now is through the glasses of nostalgia and to look at things and say, well, maybe there were, you know, society was better and things like that. However, economically speaking, there might be an argument against that. The Britain of 1982 mm-hmm. had just been suffering a extremely painful 1980s, early 1980s recession. Economic growth was just about being re-established at the start of 1982. We still had mass unemployment, 3 million unemployed, which was 12.5% unemployment rate in January 1982. That was a level not seen for 50 years. In places like the north, particularly the northeast, the northwest, in Wales, the Midlands as well, and in Scotland, unemployment was running at much higher levels than that. You had widespread social discontent. We were still in the period of Thatcherism, with the government going up against the trade unions, the strikes, and everything like that. And people were coming out of a fairly bleak period. So when we put our rose-tinted spectacles on and go, well, it was better back in the day, I don't know whether a lot of those people back in the day, if you transported them to now and let them live here for a while, would say, actually, it was better back then. I mean, beyond like maybe some of the kind of societal and things you can't put a value on stuff. But even then, I'm not so sure. But so that's the economic picture of Britain. Okay. Not amazing. We haven't had the big bang in the city yet. We hadn't had the big success of the city. If you wanted a mortgage, you were going to have to make an appointment at the building society, and you're going to have to sit there and be grilled by the building society manager, who's going to find out whether you're a person who was worthy of getting a mortgage. That said, should you have been able to, which many people did, you would have found that houses were much cheaper. The average house price back then was £24,177, according to Nationwide. It's now £254,822,000. Ah, but inflation, Simon, I hear you say. Inflation, everything's gone up in price. Well, if the average house price had risen in line with inflation, the average house today would cost you £100,000. Wouldn't that be nice if houses were 2.5 times cheaper than they are now? Median salary back then was about £8,000 a year, median full-time salary. Bear in mind that I'm going to give you some data in a minute that slightly confuses some of the figures I just said. So the median salary back then was £8,000. Now it's £31,000. Okay. The average house back then was about 4 times the average wage. Okay. That's slightly different data to the one that I was just using. And that's why it doesn't match up to 8,000 to 24,000, which would be 3. So just bear with me on that one. Nowadays, using the same data that gave us the 4 times average wages, the average house would cost you 8 times the average wage. Okay, so you can see how much harder it's got to buy the average home. The base rate back then, 14.3%. Ouch! And you wonder why readers leave comments on articles going, hike? From 0.1% to 0.25%, call that a hike. I mean, to be fair, 0.1% to 0.25% is more than doubling. But you can see why anybody who lived through double-digit interest rates gets a bit grumpy about us referring to hikes.
Are we ever likely to return to figures like that?
I sincerely hope not.
What would it take to get there? And what did it take to get where we are now?
Hyperinflation, I think it would take to get there. I honestly think that it would be almost impossible for us to return to that level because of the economic damage that it would wreak on almost, well, a large chunk of the country who have any form of mortgage or loan, the businesses that have borrowed money, all those other things. I genuinely don't think that we could get back there within decades. I mean, maybe in 40 years' time, we might have got that back there. But it's been a very gradual process to get to where we are now, and I would expect it to be a very gradual process to get back to there. I find it difficult to understand a scenario within the next 10 years where we could ever get back to 5% interest rates. Inflation, 8.6% in 1982. At the moment, that's running at 5.1%, and it's tipped to go up to 6%. I suppose that's not that far off 8.6%, is it? But maybe that's probably not going to get back there. Although some people would say we could hit double digits. That's very unlikely, by the way, people. So that's the economic picture. And as I said, I think that you would find things like if you wanted to go out and spend your money, you would be spending it on things that were distinctly inferior to what you would be spending your money on today. And you may, in many cases, find that those things used up a smaller chunk of your disposable income than buying the similar item nowadays would do. Unfortunately, the really big stuff that we have to spend money on, like houses and saving for retirement and stuff like that, has got substantially more expensive.
I mean, there's lots to dig into with that one. Obviously, it's a very different picture. I wasn't around at the time, but I wasn't really compass mentis at the time. But I remember, you know, my high street where I grew up, there was one Indian we never went to, and a Chinese that occasionally went to. And last night I had Nepalese. It was wonderful in the same town for, you know, how many years later. Choice. There's so much choice. But we've become very consumerist. I guess why people perhaps look back is they think, if you were back then, you wouldn't know what you're missing, in a way. And sometimes there's too much choice. And you can throw that in with the number of options for getting a mortgage, the investment, democratization of money, yes. But woof, the choices nowadays.
I would agree. And I think that that wealth of choice maybe comes at a cost as well, as you suggested. I would imagine, though, that in terms of the looking back through rose-tinted spectacles, it was a nicer place back then. I bet people were doing that in 1982. I bet they were looking back 20 years then and going, it was much nicer 20 years ago. I don't know. I don't know whether anyone looked back from 1982 and went, do you know what? This is peak life.
True. What about investing, Simon? What's the picture there like?
Investing. Well, if you wanted to invest in 1982, you wouldn't have just switched on your computer or got out your smartphone.
Download that.
obviously. Yeah, okay, for obvious reasons. You would have been more likely to be dealing with a financial advisor. You could be doing that in a much possibly easier way than you would be doing now. But you would probably have been having a much larger amount lifted out of your pocket in terms of commission. So, I mean, the bank, for example, would probably have done some investing for you back then. The financial advisor, it was much more the days of, oh, well, there's a bloke down the golf club I know who, why don't I introduce you to him, that kind of thing. And people invested in shares, primarily. The fund industry hadn't really grown up at that point. It was all tended to be individual share investing, maybe individual bond investing. Lots of people did it, more people than you might think. How much of that, you hadn't really had the big privatization sales by that point, the Telsid stuff and everything like that. How good a portfolio those people had, and how much was being taken in terms of, investment commission, is difficult to say, but they're probably getting a rawer deal than they would be now. But they were also getting some assistance along the way, and they were getting that kind of thing that gets you over the hurdle of starting to invest. And also investment returns were quite good back then. And so maybe you were noticing the cuts being taken by the middleman a little less. We hadn't walked into some of the later big mis-selling scandals that we had in terms of financial advice at that point.
What about savings? Seems every podcast we bemoan the savings rates, but were we all amazing savers back then? Because we didn't have quite so much junk to buy as it feels that we have now.
Well, we certainly weren't all amazing savers because a large number of us were unemployed. But if you had money and you were saving, the great advantage was is that you were seeing a return on that saving. I mean, we talked about base rate at 14%. People will have been earning, you know, potentially 10% on their money from savings accounts. And once you start to compound that up, you see that money going up and it's seen as a good thing. I mean, anybody here who is 40 will remember talk of stick it in a high interest savings account. That was always the thing. That was the thing you were told by your parents when you were a teenager. Well, you take the money and you stick it in a high interest savings account, thus indicating their experience with high interest savings accounts. I mean, even when I started at This Is Money in 2005, you could get a 5%, 6% savings rate. And you still heard people talking about taking the money and putting it in a high interest savings account. You used to get talk of people arbitraging their student loans. Take the money, don't spend it, put it in a high interest savings account. That's our generation from when we were 20. You had the savvy people who were saying, oh, do that. You had the stooging thing with credit cards, balance transfer credit cards. You take the money from the balance transfer credit card, you stick it in a high interest savings account. You're going to get 0.6% now.
Yeah.
So there is definitely people, I think, much less incentive to save. I'm not saying anybody, I'm not saying that many people I knew actually ever did any of this stuff.
This is not the conversations I had in my 20s, to tell you that.
There was always the one person who said, oh, I'll do that kind of thing. So there was much less, there was more incentive to save. There was possibly less ability to do so.
Yeah.
But then, you know, those big costs of living that we talked about, for example, the having to save for a deposit for a house or things like that, sweated less of your salary back then.
All right then, from 1982 to 2022, let's take a look at where we're at, the financial milestones. I'm going to enjoy this, aren't I? That we should have reached by 40, and if we aren't there, what on earth we can do about it? Obviously, Simon, though, this is hard because there is a no one size fits all approach, I imagine, but that that doesn't stop us journalists, me included, writing articles about how much you should have saved, invested, having a pension by 40. Are these useful? Because I've written a few now on what you should get by 30, what you should get by 40, what you should get by 50. I mean, is it a nice, interesting guide? Is it useful for people to read this stuff?
It is useful. I think it makes it good if you're above the number, okay if you're round about the number, but not so good if you're well below it or you haven't started. It can look overly daunting. So I think that sort of you should have this much by this age can really put people off sometimes. I mean, I think even when you start talking about percentages of what people are earning, they should be saving, it can put people off because they're like, hang on, how much? How am I going to do that? But, you know, that's life.
Well, that's it. It's a difficult age as well, because you are, what do they call it, the squeezed middle. So you're looking after your kids. I don't have any, but lots of people do. And you're taking care of your parents. So that kind of 40s, 50s is a really tough time, because you're thinking, well, I need to save for myself, but I've also got pressures on both sides.
Yeah, and I think most people will be more likely to be tapping up their parents at the age of 40 than sort of really overly supporting them, but some people will be supporting them. If you've got kids are expensive. If you've got a house, then you might want to be moving. But if you haven't got a house, you're thinking, oh, hang on a minute, I need to be saving for a house. And your earnings will be, you'll be on your way to peak earnings, hopefully. But it is quite an expensive time for many people, possibly more expensive than perhaps 10 years later or 10 years earlier. But then 10 years earlier, they probably felt like they never had any money.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas many people, if they're doing okay when they get to 40, at least do feel like they have some.
So let's start then. Should we go with savings? How much should you have in savings? What pot should you have? How do you prioritize them? How do you get into a good habit?
Okay, so we talked about this on the podcast, the normal podcast, last week. And we talked about this idea of thinking in three pots. And the first one of those pots is your rainy day pot. This is the money that you have in case you lose your job, the boiler breaks, the clutch goes on the car, any of those life things that just happen to befall us at possibly the worst time. There's no hard and fast rule on this, but it's usually said to be 3 to 6 months worth of post-tax wages. Now, that is quite a lot of money if you use the six-month amount. It might be perhaps that you are in a job where you have a long notice period. If you're in a job where you have a long notice period, then maybe you can go a bit more towards the three-month end of it. If you're in a job where you have a short notice period, or you're not employed and nobody else, there is no safety net there, then maybe you need to go towards the longer period. Essentially, what you're doing is making sure that you can cover yourself for long enough that if you lose your job, you can find another one. Or if you fall ill, then you can keep yourself going for a while. Again, different employers will offer you different benefits and things like that. So you have to kind of work it out yourself there. But that's your rainy day pot. And that money should be kept in cash that you can access easily. So pretty much an instant access savings account. You're not going to be earning much of a return on that. As I said, 0.6% or so at best, but it's there if you need it. The second pot is then money that was talked about for sort of medium-term spending, stuff that you've allocated that you're going to do or you're going to spend on. Now, it might be really big stuff, like saving for a house deposit. It might be bigger stuff, for example, a car, a big holiday. Most people tend to buy new cars on finance nowadays anyway, but maybe they're buying a secondhand car. A big holiday that you've got planned, getting married, a life event, or having a kid, something like that, that you want to build up that savings pot for. And you're pretty sure you want that money to be there when you need it. Now, we talked about this, as I said, on the podcast. And once again, there's varying degrees of that. If you absolutely need every single penny of that money at a certain point, you need to keep it in cash savings, not take any risk with it. If you could probably take a bit of a hit on it and you could either make it up or downgrade your expectations a bit, then maybe you could invest it, but not in anything too racy. Don't stick it in cryptocurrency, please. All of it. Don't do that. Just don't do that. Okay. I mean, I know how much you heard that person made on Dogecoin, but just if you need the money in the near term, don't do that. So you could put, or you could put some of it in cash and you could invest some of it into the stock market, maybe adopt some kind of like something steady Eddie-ish. Doesn't have to be like really boring, really cautious stuff or whatever, but you know, you're a sensible person, you're saving money, you've managed to get yourself right through to the point of 40 without like, you know, doing something so daft that you're not here anymore. So use your brain, use your noggin, think about the money properly before you do anything with it. Keep it there for what you need it for. And then you've got your third pot, which is the long-term money. It's anything over and above those other two. It's possibly money that you might never actually spend. But it's you're sort of growing your wealth, you're sticking money aside. That's the money you should be investing. That's the money you should be investing into the stock market because it's got the longest history of delivering the best inflation-beating returns. Companies can make money, they can turn a profit, they can reward shareholders, their share price can go up as people look at those good companies. You can do it in many different ways. You don't have to invest in individual shares. The best thing to do is just buy a global tracker fund and then work your way back from that if you start to get really interested in investing. And you'll thank yourself at some point in the future for doing it.
Everyone always says the best time to start investing was yesterday. Is it too late? 40? No, not really. But should you be doing anything differently in 40? Or is that a relatively good age? I suppose you're earning a bit more, so you can do a bit more with it. And
I think if you're 40 and you start investing, that's a great time to start investing. I mean, obviously, it'd be great if you'd started when you were 20 and you had loads more money, but it would always be better if you'd done something that was successful some time ago. I mean, the best time to do it is yesterday, unless the market peaked yesterday, and then that was a terrible time to do it. In all reality, most people don't invest large lump sums. They tend to invest smaller amounts and they do it over the years. And markets go up, markets go down. It's just the power of investment returns over the, over a long period, and just trying to do it in a sensible way. Get rich slow. Don't fall for the get rich stuff, quick stuff. And you will just, you know, slowly and steadily make money. You know, don't expect those spectacular Dogecoin style returns, you know, but you could be expecting maybe 5%, 7% a year kind of thing. And over the years that builds up.
You mentioned earnings there. I'm not expecting you to say how much you should be earning by 40, because, well, that depends what you do. But in terms of, have I peaked, is what I want to know. You know, is it too late for me to be a millionaire?
Absolutely not. And if you look at the studies, you will find that the characterization of the self-made millionaire, business success, entrepreneur type person, that is a young person's game, that if you haven't done it by 40, you're not going to do it, is complete and utter nonsense. The vast majority of them happen to be over 40. And I think actually maybe the biggest bucket is people in their 50s.
Oh, it's got loads of time. Got loads of time. All right, then, pension. How much should you have in your pot for a comfortable retirement by the time you're 40?
Okay, again, this is definitely one of those would have been better if you'd started when you were 20 jobs. But if you haven't started and you still need to, then just get on with it. Do it now. There are a number of different rules of thumb of how much you need to start saving, depending on the age at which you start. One of them, the most common, is half your age when you start. So if you're 40, 20% of your monthly earnings. It's quite a lot, that. If you were, for example, if you're a 40-year-old who's earning £40,000 a year, then you're getting £3,300 before tax every month. So you're going to need to be saving £670 a month. Mm-hmm. The good news is that you don't have to do all of that yourself. If you're employed, your employer is going to do some of it, potentially through auto-enrollment, but also probably through a improved pension scheme that they might have over and above that. And that makes a big difference. Basic rate pension tax relief, that'll give you an uplift of 25% on all the money that you put in. So it starts to get a bit easier than you think, but you do need to get started. We had an article actually this weekend from the Mail on Sunday, written by Rachel Rickard Strauss. In it, we had some numbers run for us by Royal London, of which, if you wanted to retire at 70 and you started at age 40 to get a comfortable retirement with a £30,600 a year income, which was up the top level of the kind of PLSA stuff, you'd need to be saving £1,000 a month. Eek. Eek. That's based on investment returns of 5% a year, inflation at 2%, and an annual management charge on your pension of 0.5%. But if you wanted a moderate retirement, then you'd need to save £480 per month. So I guess the answer is just try to start shoveling as much in there as you possibly can, certainly as much as you can, to get the rewards from your employer. And if you're self-employed, you set up your own pension and start paying some money into it. Don't just stick your head in the sand and not do it.
Do it. Now on, we've done investing, saving, pensions, how much you should earn. The final one is a bit controversial for me, having sat there at the Nepalese with my family last night, being grilled by my sister, love her dearly, why I don't own property but am shoveling money into a pension. Simon, at 40, 39 and a lot of bit, I don't own a property, I am a failure. Am I?
No, you're not a failure.
Thanks, Simon, thanks.
Some people just don't want to own property. Most people do want to own their own home, but some people don't. They like the flexibility that it gives them. And in fact, if you end up moving quite a bit and you do require that flexibility, then buying properties can prove to be an extremely expensive way of leeching money out of your bank account into the taxman's pocket through stamp duty, and potentially running the risk of mistiming the market and ending up, instead of making money from rising house prices, just continually catching it just before they go down a bit. You buy in the hot market, you have to sell in the cold market, and so on. A house is an excellent long-term investment because a bank will lend you money at interest rates that are very, very low at the moment over a very long period of time for you to repay it. And historically speaking, the value of said properties have gone up by more than the cost of the interest on the borrowed money. If you're most successful people will find that their wages will go up more on average over the years than the cost of the interest on the borrowed money, and so on and so on. And at the end of it, you can live in the house without paying any money. Whereas if you rent for the whole of your life, you'll continue to have to pay rent. But there is a big sunk cost, and that is the deposit that you have to put into buying a house nowadays. And the deposit on buying property nowadays is huge. If you buy the average house with a 20% deposit, you're sinking £50,000 into it. That's a lot of money.
No, it's true. I have just never, it's not that I don't want to own property. I would quite like to, but I've moved around a lot. And I think when people start questioning your decisions, this goes to the whole of this kind of debate about where you should be by a certain age or whatever, is it's really dependent on your personal circumstances. I must have moved about 20, 30 times since I left university because of the job I did. I was a sports reporter. I moved around the country a lot. And then I just didn't know where to live and all that sort of thing. And you know, sometimes you're single, it's very difficult to buy. Thank God I didn't buy with some exes. You know, and life changes. And actually, I have been saving up. I've been saving up into a LISA, a lifetime ISA, which obviously I could do. But as soon as you reach 40, you can't do it. So the help available gets a little bit less if you do want to get onto property. I just didn't know where to buy. And I looked, oh my goodness, I've just moved from the north where quite easily I could have just bought a place. I had the deposit ready. I've come down south. Oh, I'm not even remotely close. The difference in prices.
And I think that actually, you know, going back to, we're talking about those historic figures, it's a two-person game for most people nowadays. You've got to be in a couple, or you've got to buy with someone that you, you know, maybe a family member or someone you're very close friends with. And that is ripe for problems, to be honest, because one person quite often wants to sell at a time when another doesn't. But it's a couple's game buying property in most cases nowadays, because it's so expensive. And that's true really in many parts of the country. It's definitely more so in the south and southeast, the more expensive parts, than it is in the slightly cheaper parts, where the gap between house prices and wages is narrower. But even there, you know, earnings are lower and house prices might be lower, but our earnings are lower. So it is very, very difficult. And actually the financial damage you can do yourself by buying a home with someone that ends up in a relationship that blows up and ends up acrimonious can be much greater than the financial benefit that you can do yourself by owning said property in the first place.
So much better about being unmarried, childless, not owning a home. At least I've got a pension. Yes. And do you know what, Simon? As I reach to my 40s, I haven't really been thinking too much about it because I am just blessed in so many ways. And this podcast is one of them. So thank you very much, Simon. You've cheered me up no end. And I'm off to sun myself and have some cocktails and hopefully watch a little bit of cricket. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast paths. Join the debate and read the comments. And wish Georgie a very happy 40th birthday. Happy birthday, Georgie.
Yeah, can we just say it's like 30? If you're going to tweet anything.
It's okay. We can be like when you keep reading the same story each year at the same time of year. We'll do this podcast in a year's time and in 2 years and three years and four years and five years.
Right? And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.